New Jersey's weather and the long-term climate. Not just not in New Jersey, but just yesterday, Los Angeles topped off at 113 degrees, which was a record. Around the globe, there was a heat wave in Russia with massive forest fires, massive flooding in Pakistan, and now some flooding in Wisconsin that looks pretty bad. So it's been an interesting year for weather with lots of implications for climate. And so with that background, we wanted to have some context with all of this weather. And so we reached out to state climatologist Dave Robinson, and who apparently everybody knew Dave Robinson, even my wife, but I didn't until like just a couple weeks ago. So it's been my intense pleasure to have finally met Dave, finally met you, and to get to know you a little bit. So I'm going to roll into your bio. Dr. Dave Robinson has chaired the Rutgers University Department of Geography since 1996. He's also, as I said, the state climatologist. And I didn't really know we also had one until this year. But he conducts research of an applied nature that focuses on the diverse weather and climate of the Garden State. This includes topics such as climate change, drought, flooding, and issues involving agriculture, transportation, public safety, and commerce. The Office of the New Jersey State Climatologist also operates one of the most spatially dense observing networks in the nation. The New Jersey Weather and Climate Network provides timely information to decision makers, the research community, and the general public. So it's a very important position. Dr. Robinson has also served on a number of national committees and has published research works on issues related to his interest in the collection and archiving of accurate climate data. He's also called upon frequently by the region's news media to provide insights about weather trends. As of yesterday, my wife, working for the Bergen Record, called you up. The right story. Dr. Robinson holds a PhD in geology from Columbia University, where he also earned a master's degree in geology and philosophy. In addition, Dr. Robinson earned his bachelor's degree in geology from Dickinson College. So without further ado, introduce Dr. Robinson.
Jeff, thanks very much. Yeah, when the weather gets crazy, I become ubiquitous. And drought's worse than anything else because it never ends and never ends. Do these lights go off, I wonder? Get a little better view of the slideshow. Professors can never talk without PowerPoint these days. So, well, if you're going to promise to stay awake. You're in a light back there. No, that's great, Jeff. That was great, actually. Yeah, I think so. That really shows it. And we have a cloudy day. I spoke at a Delaware flood warning forum in Easton last week. And we were in a room with windows facing the south on this bright, sunny day, and you could hardly see a thing. Of course, then we went and talked drought on the side while we were at a flood meeting. That's the way it is. I mean, that's kind of the way it is around here these days, it seems. Tomorrow, I go to Trenton to testify for the second month in a row at an NJDEP drought hearing. That's something that needs to be held publicly before drought restrictions can be imposed on purveyors and consumers. But of course, it's raining, because that always happens when we have a drought hearing. The last time before these two drought hearings was 2005 in October, and it occurred in the midst of one of the wettest weeks on record, and it ended up October of 2005 being the wettest month of any month in New Jersey since statewide records began in 1895. So now we're looking at an inch or so of rain that's fallen in the last day. But if you looked at the forecast this morning, there's a slug of tropical moisture due up here Thursday. We may get 3 to 5 inches of rain on Thursday. It's still too soon to see if it's going to stay offshore or not. But it would stand to reason it's going to happen. So have a drought, call a drought hearing. Sometimes you yell a little too loud. Now, this is not Floyd, as some people suspected, but if you read a little print, this is only the second worst flood on the Raritan in the last 200 years, namely April 2007. The 99 Floyd flood was the worst. That's the new Route 18 through New Brunswick. That's the Raritan River normally. Jeff mentioned the State Climate Office. This is our mission, monitor with our weather network to understand students working out, working with all types of user communities out there, and inform the hundreds of interviews each year, the website. This is our website. You can click on that map, and that brings you to our weather network, which is an hourly update from upwards of 150 stations around the state, and we grab some from surrounding states. You can see a monthly narrative here. This included August and the summer, and you can link to past narratives. We have something here with our Water Watch where you can link to all things flood and drought. We borrow from many people. We have original data of our own on here as well, so I invite you to scroll or surf your way through this site. So, traveling through New Jersey or not, have to put that transportation spin on it to begin with. Then we'll talk just a couple slides, your climate 101. Then a little, is Jersey's climate changing? And if so, why? And then, well, get out the foggy crystal ball and look at the coming decades and what we might expect, which I know is something near and dear. This is just a great group to talk to because you think in decades. Climatologists think in decades. Climatologists need patience. Meteorologists are hyperactive. They just need to know what's happening today, tomorrow, and the next couple days. Climatologists, we have to be calm, as you can tell. I'm so calm. Addressing climate change, we'll look a little at our network. Addressing climate change is just going to be a couple of things. One thing pulled out of a National Research Council report on transportation and climate change, and then a little bit on our networks. And all that in the next 5 minutes. Weather and climate affect everything. Indirectly or directly, at least half of the gross national product is affected. Trillions of dollars by weather and climate. Think about it on a day-to-day. Even your decision to drive to the shore because the weather's nice, let alone your decision not to drive to the shore and support our shore economy, agriculture, the meadowlands, think sea level rise and change. Transportation, as I mentioned later, just recreation, there's your transportation, fire and public safety. And yes, only New Jersey could have a Fitzpatrick Jewish deli. It's down in Burlington. And the reason I put that there, because it just represents commerce, represents New Jersey commerce, from mom and pop to the big PS folks right next door. And as I said, transportation, yes, to be sure, absolutely. Some flooding on the Millstone in Manville. I have shots from the same bridge in southern Manville in 1907 and this past March showing the flooding there near home. This is the Millstone River in Millstone. Not overtopped this March. It did cover a good portion of the roadway back with Floyd. That's Easton Avenue in Somerset part of Franklin Township. That's Raritan tributary flooding. But transportation and your knowledge of climate goes back to the time of the Indian trails. This is a map from an atlas that just came out 2 years ago. Well, a year ago, actually. It was really hit last year. Mapping New Jersey. I really recommend this. Not because I'm associate editor of the environmental chapter, and geographers galore at Rutgers are involved. This is the neatest book that's come out on an atlas of New Jersey in decades, and it's Amazon, I think you can get it for like $25. It's fantastic. It's got a whole section on transportation. Oh, I'll show you a couple maps from there, but it's loaded with maps, new and old, original, grabbed from the Library of Congress. But the point of showing this is the Indian trails, and look at there, you know, Route 9 or the Parkway, and you can see the roads, the Indian trails through the state, and they knew where to put their trails. They didn't put them through the swamps. They put them on the terminal moraine, where Route 80 sits today. So there's been this link between weather and climate and transportation back to the times of the Indians walking their way around New Jersey. This is one map. Our cartographer in our department, Mike Siegel, was the main cartographer for this, and this is one of his neatest maps. And you can see the network today and how it's developed, and there's so many ways of looking at this as if I have to tell folks here. Transportation, yes, transportation, not. That's a shot up in West Milford in the last storm of this year, up in March. Excuse me, late February, when they had about 30 inches of snow. It took a while for the snow to make it to North Jersey this past winter. It started in the south and migrated north. This is an ice storm actually at High Point State Park several years ago in November. But again, to point out the fact that transportation is so dangerous and so susceptible to the weather, especially when it gets to ice storms. And I'll show you another example of that later. And then some fair weather transportation, leafing through the Delaware Raritan Canal. You can see in some shots here, the kayaking along canals and rivers, a cow on the towpath there. But just wonderful examples of transportation around that. I live about a half mile from the Delaware Raritan, and I bike it, and I run it, and canoe it. And then, of course, just down the road here, the major transportation hub with bridges that might be a little too low, right down in the port. Rail. Here's an old map from, again, you can find it in Mapping New Jersey, of rail lines in 1876. Freight and fledgling passenger lines as the suburbs began to exist thanks to the rails. A train museum in a lair, I got that shot from. Does anybody know what this is? Sometimes transportation grounds to a halt, I guess you could say. I dare say no one really personally remembers this. This is out in Sussex County after the blizzard of 1888, a blizzard that put drifts of snow up to the second floor of buildings in downtown New York City and just paralyzed this area in mid-March. But then this is, as I said, transportation not sometimes. That person has to be very happy they left home, about 1 second later than they might have. Because you can see the double line. That's not a parked car. The tragedy we had over in Brooklyn just a couple weeks ago. And with this storm, a tragedy of two pedestrians up in Teaneck. This is the March storm of this year, which put more wind damage into the state probably than any storm since David in 1979, Tropical Storm David. This is up in Bergenfield. Car driving down the street just had a tree fall right on the front end of it. All right, so a little bit of doom and gloom and worries and positive things about the multitude of ways we can move around, but how they're all somewhat weather dependent. Now let's back off and do the climate 101. Take home point of this slide. The climate system is incredibly complex. This figure centers on a car and a road. But we've got the oceans, we've got the atmosphere, we have various landscapes. We have the sun powering it all. We have volcanoes throwing up aerosols, fine particles into the atmosphere and influencing the climate from time to time. It's just incredibly complex, all of these things acting simultaneously, all with a different beat. It's quite a dance. And this is my cop-out slide, too. This is where I explain how could we ever know what the climate's going to be exactly in the future, because it's so complicated. But it truly is. And here in the middle latitudes, as I say here, we're in a real squeeze play. We don't grow most of our own weather. We tend to import it. This summer, we imported it from the south, and it was strong enough to keep the cooler air from the north. So it's a battle in the summer. Where's that Bermuda high pressure system? This year it was huge. It came over the eastern United States and it didn't budge. So it kept a lot of the moisture away and it kept the cool air away. But we're always in that battle. Here we are, halfway to the pole, sort of, halfway to the equator, with a big continent to our left and a big ocean to our right. We're just squeezed into all of this. And that's what makes our weather so variable. It gives us four very distinct seasons. It gives us the day-to-day variability that we all have experienced. And it was 90 degrees on Saturday. cool air came in, it was 70 Sunday. Now we've got the pipeline open to the south and just this hose of moisture coming up the east coast. It looks like there's a pattern change underway and it's going to get cooler next week. How long is that going to stay? We've been, as we'll see later, above normal 7 straight months, so don't give up on October being warm yet just because it may get cold, cooler earlier next week. And I know people are worried now. My first leaf peeping interview yesterday. How the leaves going to be this year? On a scale of 1 to 10, I said, well, it's not going to be a 10 if 10's best. It's been too dry. Leaves are already falling. I said, 6 to 8. Well, we are in a drought. I said, but we started very wet, and some trees don't mind being a little water starved. They have deeper roots and whatever. Other trees, they're miserable or dead already if you go through parts of the state. But we're in that squeeze. What may happen next, one never knows. And in Jersey, it's a wonderful state, my home state, and I know some of yours, can be broken down even into parcels of its own. The hilly northwest, here through the Piedmont, the transportation population corridor, what I call the banana belt of the southwest, where a lot of truck crops are grown, the wonderful, unique pinelands, and then, of course, the influence of the ocean and the coastal area. So we have very distinct climates, and you folks are responsible for 1, 2, 3, 4 of them here in this agency. Responsible for them? You have to live with them, I guess, is better. Okay, there's your 101. Is New Jersey's climate changing, and if so, why? New Jersey climate changes a lot. I mentioned glacial moraines earlier, but anywhere from here on north and west in North Jersey was under ice 20,000 years ago. So what are humans? We weren't around influencing that. What's the big deal with what humans may be doing to the climate when 20,000 years ago there was 1,000 feet of ice over High Point and Central Park? The darker blue, whoops, is actually where there was earlier ice within the last 1 million years. So climate changes naturally. That's a big point. Everyone kind of knows, but it changes on huge scales. And no one denies that. Volcanoes affect climate on short scales. Glacial intervals affect climate on multi-millennial, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000-year time scales. That's what makes this whole trying to unravel the picture of where humans are involved all the more difficult, because there's so much natural variability as well. So how do you extract any human influence from this natural variability? And the answer is it's difficult, but we're working on it. We have records going back, instrumental records going back over 100 years in New Jersey. I have some records from New Brunswick back to the 1850s pretty much every day, but we don't know where the thermometers were located. We don't know what they used for a rain gauge. We know they didn't measure every snowstorm, but I can extract about every major snowstorm in central Jersey back to the 1850s. But I can't give you the annual totals until 1893. But these records go back for temperature and precipitation back to 1895 through 2009. Each bar is a year. These are long-term means for the early part of the 20th century. That's the last 30 years of the 20th century, and that's this past decade. And you have to be careful when you compare different time intervals, but it's better than just putting one simple regression on this. But the take-home point here simply is New Jersey is getting wetter. Look at the major wet years we've had in the last several decades that you didn't find previously. Yet you have some dry ones, too. So one could say New Jersey is getting wetter, and our precipitation regime is becoming more variable. So it's not just about the means. It's all not just about one extreme. It may be the range of extremes. Temperature-wise, notice I put precip on top and temperature below because I think precipitation is a lot more important than temperature. We made it through a record hot summer and a very dry summer, but I dare say if we were any drier, we would have been impacted a lot more than if we had just been a little warmer. But we are getting warmer. Again, the long-term mean, 30 years, 71 to 2000, and this decade. And look at the number of warm years. But we had a warm year back in the 30s. This variability has occurred before. Yesterday was the warmest on record in downtown Los Angeles. Other areas, I saw a list of OBS this morning from out there. There apparently was a big heat wave in June of 1917 because a lot of stations there either broke that record or that's still their record. So there's been heat in the past, the Dust Bowl of the 30s. So what oftentimes we see now is nothing more than perhaps more frequent heat, but perhaps not exceeding what we've experienced at times further in the past. So New Jersey is, though, getting warmer. New Jersey is getting wetter. This is just the last 12 months drilling down to the present. This is the kind of figure that I'll be showing at the drought meeting tomorrow. This shows you above average rainfall in the green and below average from last September through this past August. And you can see we had the wettest December, fifth wettest February, wettest March on record. We were soaked by the end of March. The wettest 12-month period of any of the 1,400 12-month periods since 1895, ending with this past March. And then someone turned the faucet off. Because look at the last 5 months. Right now, if September were to end, we'd be about 2 inches below here. But stay tuned. We'll see what Thursday has to say about that. But interestingly enough, here's a piece of trivia. Thursday is the 30th, right? Most of the stations that grab this, that we use for this, and it's several dozen stations, some of them go back like New Brunswick to 1893 and 1895 with these records. But they've been volunteer manual observations for decades. And the Weather Service long ago asked that observations be taken about 7 to 8 in the morning because they needed to make the river flood forecasts and things like that for the day. So most of these observations are taken in the morning. And once they're taken at 7 a.m. on Thursday morning, September's over. And October 1st begins. They say, that's nuts. There's still 17 more hours of September, and it's going to count as October. But for you trivia buffs, it will. So if that heavy rain falls Thursday, it's going to count as October rain for the most part. There are a few stations where it will be that record in the evening. So I hate it when it rains on the last day of the month. And you can imagine what I feel when it rains or snows on the last day of the year. But that's the weather abnormality. So, and they're just these artificial segregation by 12 units over the course of the year anyway. So, but we'll see. So September is probably going to be a dry month simply because it's not going to rain until after the OBS are taken Thursday morning. One thing I can tell you for sure, warmest spring, March, April, May on record. Warmest summer, June, July, August. This month right now is running about 3 degrees above normal. Might be in the top 10 of the last 116. Every one of these, fifth out of 116, number one, number six, number two in July, in June, number two July, and oh, a measly only 10th warmest August. Which is disappointing, right? Because last August was the sixth warmest. So it actually cooled this August compared to last August. This is remarkable. This is one of the more remarkable climate extremes this state's experienced in the last century. To go 2 degrees Fahrenheit, when you combine those 6 months together, it broke the previous record for those 6 months by a full 2 degrees. That's like shattering the home run record by 30 home runs or something like that. That's huge in climate parlance. Averaged over 6 months to be 2 degrees above the previous record. So this has just been a remarkable string of warmth. Why? Well, I told you there's been this persistent Bermuda high. Why has the Bermuda high been persistent? That's how we have to drill down to find out what the attribution for these conditions might be. Here's the summer, just going back, number one. Number two was 2005, a half degree lower. Then you go a degree and a half lower to 49, then 99, 2002, 2006, 55, 2008, whoop, 1900, 43, 73. But look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of the top 8 since 1999. And how far back do these state records go? 1895 for the state, New Brunswick 93. 1895. And 6 of the 8 warmest of that 116-year record have been. And you can say this for months. You can say this for years. Right now, we're running record warmth for any year. We'll see what October, November, and December bring. And there's a cornfield down the block from my home in Somerset County. Here's our precipitation for the summer, ranked number 8. But look up the list there. It's the driest summer since 1966. Oh, what? Oh, 99 before Floyd was dry. Yes, it was. I think it came in 12th. But it got wet later in August, and that helped knock it out of the top 10. So the driest summer since 1966 we've just experienced. But you notice more dryness earlier in the 20th century, not nearly as much in the last several decades. So what's this all about? As I said, we can talk about the week-to-week, season-to-season attributions, but what about the big picture? What about these multi-decadal warm, this multi-decadal warm period we're in right now? And there's this greenhouse effect. I'm not going to get into the thermodynamics of this or anything. Suffice, think of it as a blanket on a bed. We naturally, we get cold, we put a blanket on us. We get warmer, but we don't keep heating up and heating up and heating up and suddenly explode into flames. We reach some kind of an equilibrium. But if we're still cool, what do? Throw another blanket on top of that one. And what you're doing is taking your body's heat and retaining it close to the body and eventually ridding it out into your bedroom off the top of the blanket. But you're holding, if you will, or retaining that heat for a longer period of time than if you were fully exposed without any blanket there. So naturally, we have a greenhouse over the earth of carbon dioxide, methane, and water vapor, the biggest of the greenhouse gases. Without that natural greenhouse, the earth's average temperature, based on the amount of energy it gets from the sun, would be an ice cube. It would be about 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So thank goodness for the greenhouse effect. It makes our planet about 58 degrees Fahrenheit on average near the surface. But what humans are doing are adding another blanket. They're raising the methane levels and the chlorofluorocarbons and, of course, the carbon dioxide levels. And they're throwing maybe just a sheet on top of that blanket, but enough of a sheet that it's expected, theoretically, that the Earth should warm underneath that blanket or that assemblage of blankets. Theoretically, this is proven. So theory behind this with the greenhouse effect. Next, we look at models. These sophisticated yet in some ways very primitive ways of recreating the Earth numerically. At all levels, from the bottom of the ocean to the top of the atmosphere, across various landscapes, interchange. It's like this three-dimensional, four-dimensional chessboard with multiple variables in there. But wonderful modeling that's been going on for about 40 years and continues to grow in sophistication. So we've got models, we have theory, and we have some observations, obviously, too. So what scientists did for the last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which was out in 2007, there's AR5 is in the works right now. They went and ran these models for the last century. And they said, let's run the models without any human input of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. We'll just put in volcanic activity changing and the solar constant changing a little bit. And they got this blue area with a little wiggle room around it. That's what it showed from 1900 to 2000. That's how the temperatures of the planet should have behaved. Then they went and said, well, we'll keep the volcanoes. That's, for instance, Mount Pinatubo-related cooling in 1992. But we'll add greenhouse gases, and we'll add some dust, too, which actually helps to cool the planet. And they ran it, and they got this red line and the wiggles around it. What's the black line? If you read closely, that's what the observation shows have occurred in the last century. So what this shows you that up till about 1960, the natural only and the human and natural model runs were neck and neck with one another, and they jive pretty well with the observational record. Come about 1960, the only way you can explain where the temperatures have gone with observations is using the model that includes the human component. If you don't have the human component, we should be 6 to 7, 8 tenths of a degree Celsius cooler on this planet this decade and last decade. Is this proof positive? No. But it incorporates theory, modeling, and observations. So if you will, the preponderance of evidence points to a human impact on the global climate system. Preponderance. Not every piece, but preponderance of evidence. This is understood and accepted by the vast majority of practicing climatologists out there today. There are skeptics. Some of them, you might ask where their background in climatology and observations and modeling might be. But scientists by our very nature are skeptical. So there's nothing wrong with some skepticism and a little needle to prove it. But that's when you might take that leap away from the scientific realm into the political realm. And sometimes I talk at meetings where, with environmentalists, and I feel I'm the most conservative person in the room. Other times I go talk, I've talked at business meetings, and I feel like I'm a flaming liberal. And I guess that's good, because that means I'm somewhere in the middle. Because there's all sides to this, but oftentimes these ends of it are trying to fit the facts to their ideas. Whereas hopefully the vast majority of people are trying to look at the evidence and make educated judgments. And the general consensus of the science community is that humans are having a major impact on the global climate system. People say that's all a hoax and it's a conspiracy. Well, I'm a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I wrote, co-authored the subchapter on snow cover, because I study that when I'm not wearing my state climatologist hat. And you can imagine getting all of us together to agree on something and do it internationally and then feed it by the governments of all the nations. Those IPCC reports, the one that Gore took all that information from, and the IPCC shared the Nobel Prize with Gore, Peace Prize in 07, you'd know that's actually a conservative view of where things are going because it's been vetted by so many people. So what about the future? Sum it up with one slide here. We're going to continue to get warm in New Jersey. I see no reason for any abatement of the warmth. Will every year be warmer than the last year? Absolutely not. But the general trend with variations from year to year embedded within it, it's going to be upwards. If a volcano comes to bear, we might cool for a couple of years. Just natural variability may cause cooling for a few years. There may be certain feedbacks in the system that cool things down. But temperatures are going to keep rising. There's nothing not to believe so. Steady or increasing precipitation. Most models, and there's a variety of models out there, several dozen credible models, suggest that this part of the world, the middle latitudes along the eastern side of the North American continent, should have similar or perhaps increasing precipitation to what we've experienced the last couple of decades. No model suggests drying here in the mid-Atlantic. The Southwest may be in on that, and there was an interesting article in the Times today on water availability in the Southwest, and we had a visitor from Arizona State speak at our department colloquium Friday about water use in Arizona. And she goes, we're much more concerned in Phoenix about air pollution than water, because water is about one quarter the price in Phoenix as it is here in New Jersey. Go figure. But maybe a wake-up call in that Times article today. But again, that's steady increasing precipitation averaged over years. That may not tell the whole story, because all the models suggest increasing variability and extremes. So you can't just say, oh, it's going to get wetter. But maybe the rain is going, it looks like the rain has already begun on a national and some areas elsewhere in the globe. More of your rain's falling in intense events. And then you have big gaps between those events where drought may ensue. So we may have a more a streakier type of regime in our precipitation. And you may look back at the last decade in New Jersey and go, yeah, we're already seeing that. Extremes, by their definition, are rare. So you can't just look at a decade worth of rainfall and drought and or temperatures and say, oh, we're more extreme in New Jersey. But there are signs pointing in that direction with the flood frequencies we've had, with the heat that we've experienced. I know a lot of people want to take our record snowy February, and in southern half of the state, the record snowy last winter, and say, oh, that's because of global warming. We can talk about that afterwards. It's not nearly that simple. And eventually it's going to get too warm for it to snow all that often around here. And then something I know is very interesting to people here, rising sea level. Right now the more credible, well, we'll get to that in a second. Let me just talk a little bit about the warming we've seen in the last century or so. Even if we walked home and didn't turn on our furnaces or our air conditioning units, there's enough energy heat in the ocean that we'd continue to warm, even if we stopped all the greenhouse warming. But with future emissions, the question is, do we do some mitigative activities, or do we just go for it in terms of how much it's going to warm in the future? Heat index. This is a combination of temperature and humidity. It's kind of hard to see here. This is the New York metropolitan area, as it is today. And if we take some mitigative approaches to our greenhouse emissions, we, by the end of this century, will likely have the climate somewhere from D.C. to Richmond, maybe down to Norfolk. If we let it run amok, we could be more like Columbia, South Carolina, and boy, that's hard, to Savannah, Georgia. There's Florida right here. So it's not like we're suddenly going to start growing palm trees or suddenly going to have the climate of Miami. But and it's not this simple, because when we have the climate of this area, we're still going to be this close to the pole and late season cold outbreaks. So this might mean, oh, great, the trees start blossoming, the fruit trees start blossoming in March, and then zap, a late season cold spell comes down from the north because we're that much closer to the pole than, say, Georgia or South Carolina would be today. So it's really tricky when you look at some of these. And this is a cartoonish type of map to give you a little idea what might go on. And then more in the way of extremes. This is 2002 March out at Spruce Run Reservoir. That's one of the three Delaware floods of 04, 05, 06. That's the 06 one. About 100 yards away, I gave my talk on flood warning over in Easton from this bridge last week. Sea level. When the 2007 IPCC report came out, they were talking about a 4/10 of a meter rise by the end of this century. It was already understood when that report came out that that was old news. They had to freeze the scientific studies in 2005 because you had to get this international publication done. But by 07, we already knew those were low-balled estimates. And the new estimate is about a meter rise. Now, there's room for wiggle room on that. That takes into account some ice sheet melting. Trouble is, you could take this assemblage of people here and call it the ice sheet modeling international meeting, and that would be about it. There are not a lot of ice sheet modelers that know with any great certainty what Greenland and Antarctica are going to do. We know it's getting warmer up there. I have a NASA project right now where we're looking at snow on top of the Greenland ice sheet and the sea ice of the Arctic and continental snow. And the amount of snow that melted, the area of snow melt on top of Greenland this past summer was a record for the last 20 years. That's not even been out in the press yet. It's just broken, and it's starting earlier in the spring and going into September, where it didn't do that 20 years ago. But it's still, unfortunately, we only have 20 years of record. So figure right now, subject to some change, of course, a meter change in sea level. That might be important news for those people down along the Jersey Shore. Because think about increased storminess that might happen with waves on top of that meter rise in sea level. Anybody familiar with this report? This is out a couple years ago. I participated in one meeting down in Washington on this one. The National Research Council put out this very lengthy report. You can get it online. I went and grabbed this yesterday because I couldn't find my copy, and I got the PDF. I think, I don't want to sound supercilious or anything, but I sit on the National Research Council's Climate Advisory Committee, so I'm not so sure if I got in because it knew my password or whether I could have gone in as John and Jane Q. Public. I think it's publicly available because it was published a couple years ago. You were able to grab it? It's really, I mean, it's bedtime reading. It's some lengthy reading, but I would recommend it. It was done by a fine panel and a Committee on Climate Change and U.S. Transportation, the Transportation Research Board, and Division of Life and Earth Sciences of the National Research Council. This is what they talk about for U.S. transportation. More hot days and heat waves, Arctic temperature increases, sea level rise, the intensity of precip, and they talk about increases in hurricane intensity. That's a little contentious. The World Meteorological Organization refuses to make a call on that. We're not sure. Why should we worry about the Arctic? Well, because of the Greenland ice sheet and rising sea level, of course. But for you transportation folks, look at a ship going right through the Northwest Passage. There's a ship this summer trying to circumnavigate, two ships trying to circumnavigate the Arctic Ocean. I guess they had to come south of Greenland and up and around. This is the ice map from last week. This is what the long-term average is up there. 2007 had the lowest ice extent. The blue line is this year. We tied for the second lowest about a week ago. Thought we weren't going to get to the second lowest. When I was in North Carolina at the National Data Center, I was sitting with the guy who creates this map, and we were having dinner. He says, we've leveled out, but we haven't told anyone yet. I said, oh, well, I'm glad he didn't, because it dropped again the next week. Second lowest extent. When I was in grad school, to think that there'd be this little ice in the Arctic Ocean at the end of the summer, I would have never imagined. To me, this is almost the canary in the mine. I know it simplifies things. I've been astounded by the loss of Arctic sea ice. Now remember, sea ice doesn't change sea level. Ice on land that melts changes sea level. So when we're talking sea level, we're talking Greenland or the Antarctic. When we're talking circumnavigation and a much shorter route from Asia over to the Port Newark, we're talking sea ice. Going back to sea level, and this doesn't come out well at all. This is from the NRC report, and you can see gray shaded areas. And those are areas that are within 3 meters of sea level. And that includes all of Newark Airport, but I'm sure most of you are familiar with that already. Certainly the Meadowlands and such. That's 3 meters. No one's saying sea levels go rise 3 meters, although Al Gore kind of alluded to it in Inconvenient Truth, and it was a very weak presentation on his part. But a meter is certainly within range, and then you throw storm waves on top of that, and we're going to have planning issues, infrastructure problems. problems that you can consider. Finally, addressing climate change. Just gotta quickly throw these. This is when I start preaching. No, but we need the knowledge. We need to consider mitigation. We're not gonna mitigate ourselves out of this. You folks, that's important to know. We're gonna have to learn to adapt. We're already learning to adapt. And then we need some leadership. And I'll leave that as a quick one. But this is another slide, the last slide from that report, where it talks about greenhouse emissions, climate change, mediating environmental effects, impacts on transportation infrastructure, policies and actions, adaptation, policies and action, mitigation. A very simple, rather elegant diagram of how transportation fits neatly into this important picture of our global climate and climate change. Now, just to finish up with a few couple slides, this is something that may interest those in operations as more than the longer term figuring, because most of these stations that are reporting in our weather network are electronic stations that only go back 10 years or less. But this is our main page where you can go and drill into any particular station you want. You can look at temperature, precipitation, solar radiation, soil moisture, barometric pressure, winds, speeds, directions. This one, though, I pulled out because this was a great contentious debate between NJDOT and New Jersey Office of Emergency Management a couple years ago. Sunday evening, the 2nd of December, 2007, and this is our map where we pull weather radars and drape it over top a map of current temperatures. Can't get this anywhere else, I don't think. And here it's in the 40s and raining. Here it's in the 20s and not precipitating. Right here in central New Jersey, it's between 29 and 32 degrees and raining. The roads of central Jersey turned into an ice skating rink that evening. It didn't rain a lot. Those are not heavy echoes. The heavy rains were where it was in the 40s. You really can't see the numbers here, but some stations were coming in with freezing rain. Boy, I got calls from both. OEM, how come DOT didn't respond? DOT, what's OEM? This, just a little bit of freezing rain. And this, using our network, we have a detailed picture. You normally, with just the weather service, have 12 stations. Instead, we have about 100 stations reporting. You don't even see them all here with the radar. So that's where we hope we're making a difference for the safety in the state. This is a simple page. Forest Service uses one to monitor forest fires and control burning. This is transportation. It's just from yesterday, and you can see this is DOT stations along roadways. Some say wet, some say dry. A lot of unknowns here yesterday. When there's hazardous situations, like relative humidity was high or it was a little windy yesterday, it alerts the DOT to this. We were given some support for DOT to develop this and support our network. That was a couple years ago. I dare say, a couple from DOT are here. I don't think anybody at DOT even remembers this exists now, yet we still have it. Everybody's funding. We have another network that I just want to mention briefly. It's got over 400 volunteers, of which about 150 will report on any given day, of rainfall and snowfall around the state. Now, that's after the fact, 7 a.m. in the morning. However, the transportation community finds it interesting, and certainly we resolve millions of dollars of snow plowing contracts. This is the storm totals for the February 10th, 11th storm this past winter. Anything in this shading is over about 10 inches. A little less here, a little less down in Cape May for that storm. We put together 200 observations of snowfall after that storm for retrospective study and resolution of plowing contracts in many cases. So just to give you an idea. And automated stations don't do this well. We need humans with rulers out there measuring snow. This, which I'll probably show again at the drought meeting tomorrow, is the precipitation map we produce every day. This is the drought-saving rain of August 22nd up in the northwest part of the state, which brought the reservoirs temporarily up to average in the Hackensack basin. But we got a lot of different observations. But with that, I might suggest do not enter that way. And thanks. If there's a little time for questions, or we want to wait till Christine's done and we do questions.
Wireless mics, are there any questions?
Stunned you.
I was just wondering what influence the jet stream has on periods of drought or periods of rainfall. I know they said this past summer the jet stream stayed way up north, for instance.
Yeah, the jet stream is kind of that river of air, if you will, that divides polar air masses from milder air masses. It tends to ride to our north during most of the summer. Occasionally, it will drop down in here. And in the winter, storms ride along that jet stream, kind of like pearls on a necklace. That obviously stayed way out of the way. All the storms are shunted to the north this summer. Last winter, the storms went up the East Coast, in part influenced by an El Nino event in the tropical Pacific. This winter, there's a La Nina event underway already. That tends to bring that storm track and the jet stream up through the Ohio Valley and the Great Lakes. So it's all, what will the future positioning of that be as the Earth warms? Part of that's fired by thermal differences between the pole and the equator. The pole's going to warm more relative to its past than the equator. So it might actually weaken the jet and allow it to lift and stay further north, which would add more heat to the equation. So you can look at that jet stream on a week-to-week, season-to-season, and yes, I think this winter's going to be less snowy. Not than last winter. That's a real easy one. But than normal. We've looked at the last 7 La Ninas, and we've had slightly below average precipitation. And temperature is a little milder than normal. So that would be what I look at in the short term. In the long term, the jet may weaken and just sit further north and expose us to more of the type of weather we had this summer. Not necessarily drought, but certainly not the cold weather that, I mean, we've forgotten what average is. We haven't had anywhere near an average month since February. So March, it's warm for March. April, it's our first 90-degree day this year. Anybody remember? It's April 7th. It's the earliest on record. And we just had a 90-degree day in parts of the state on Saturday.
There's the only people who look at longer term than climatologists maybe would be historians. Mm-hmm. And Barbara Tushman wrote an incredible book, Through a Distant Mirror, she actually was writing about medieval Europe, but she actually ended up describing the mini ice age start and how it dramatically affected Europe. I think she put it at 1280, basically starting in northern Europe with the weather climate change. And ironically, at the other end of Europe, the Black Death came in, the plague through Constantinople, and it literally converged in central Europe. She basically was talking in the book about how they were no longer able to grow crops in northern Europe that they'd grown for generations and whatever. And, you know, farming in those days was father to son or whatever else. They didn't know exactly how to modify their farming techniques or whatever else and plants and different things. She also said this is the reason why the Vikings abandoned Greenland, stopped earlier trying to go further, east, further west again, to America and stuff like that. Iceland became really isolated as a thing, because they couldn't go there all the time. And this whole thing about the climate of northern Europe actually went from Scandinavia all the way to central Germany. And at the same time when these people were suffering from all these climatic changes, the ironic thing is that the Black Death is coming in and hitting a population that's been so weakened by all these famines and stuff. So, it's funny. There's also, when you see these references, by the way, this is really amazing. North Africa was once referred to as the breadbasket of the European, of the Roman Empire, up until after 400 AD. And something happened there climate-wise. I've never seen it written up or whatever else, but dramatic changes.
Oh, there's no question. The climate, paleoclimatologists are historians. I've dabbled a little in that. The climate has changed naturally in the past. There's no one suggesting there's a human impact there. That little ice age, there's some evidence for it outside of the North Atlantic Basin, but it seemed to concentrate more there, probably influenced by circulation regimes in the northern Atlantic Ocean. But it led to some profound changes in the climate over generations in that area. So there has been this natural variability in the past. And again, as I said earlier, that's what makes extracting the human signal all the more confounding. But the fingerprint that the humans are leaving is different than the fingerprint we saw in those older climate changes, which tended to be more regional in nature. This has broader implications, and it's happening in areas that the modeling and the theory suggest have that human impact. But it's not to discount the major fluctuations that were observed in centuries past. I'll hang around later, too, if we...
Are they expected to have any appreciable impact?
Yeah, and you could see that with that cartoon map I showed. It may keep us in D.C. and not in Columbia. Absolutely. I don't mean, I've been saying we're not going to mitigate ourselves out of this, and was using the word adaptation in my classes 15 years ago, and it wasn't quite in vogue, where everyone, and I think politicians for the most part, still think we can do mitigation, although you're starting to hear the A word more. But there's certainly things we can do to mitigate. We don't have to let it run amok, as I said earlier. But let's face it, we're already having an impact, and there's no way we're going to stop that train. It kind of left the station, but we can kind of slow it down.
Right.
I don't know, my mind just went to it. If you leave station A at this time, I don't know, but just went back to math class.
Hi, my name is Jay. Thank you so much for the detailed explanation in such a short time. I'd like to connect two different places in your presentation. When we started, we look at the pictures of floods on the roads. Now, one thing that I think, is it because of the climate changing that the floods are there, or is it because the road is not in the right place? Now, there's more planning today, but the planning is because we have data for today. 10 years down the line, the road that goes right here might be right today, but 10 years down the line, with the climate changing, when we go back to the last part of your presentation, mm-hmm. where you said that it's going to be more variable and intense. So as a system, if you look at the state of New Jersey, the entropy or the randomness is increasing. And in our planning, we are actually decreasing the randomness. So there's this big disconnect between today and 10 years down the line. Right. And how does mitigation or adaptation work there?
You must have a geography degree, because that's really, geographers are studying that nexus between humans and the environment. And we're more, another word that's big right now out there is the V word, vulnerability. And we've left ourselves in more vulnerable positions today. We're living closer to the edge. You may think we're a more modernized society, but in some ways we're just pushing it. And modern society isn't going to be able to handle major changes in sea level and storminess and what have you with great ease. And in some cases, we've left ourselves more vulnerable. But let me back off quickly on all of that, because still, the impoverished populations of the world are in greater danger. Yeah, we may not be able to get into Atlantic City to gamble, but other areas affected by sea level, other areas that are affected by this increase with storm frequency. We saw it in Pakistan this summer. We've seen it elsewhere. So I don't want you leaving thinking, he's saying that our more developed society is more vulnerable and is going to take the hurt more than the undeveloped society. That's not the case. But having said that, we are, here in the developed New Jersey, left ourselves more vulnerable than ever before from where we're living. But it's great that the road's flooding and not the buildings. And I've got a picture of the other side of New Brunswick over in Piscataway. I can show you a pavilion where you can barely see the roof. But it's in Johnson Park. and that's a good place to have a flood occur. But still, we are vulnerable, no question about
just
it.
Just two more short questions. Those were Randy. And
Randy?
You got a question? Your climate shift cartoon map, were those projections based on the moderate conservative IPC projections or the emerging scarier consensus?
No, they were the more moderate IPCC type projections where they're dealing, you know, because they deal with several different scenarios of carbon dioxide change, some where it's left unregulated, uncontrolled, others where they level off. This is the more intermediate projection. So that's it's more the moderate look. It's certainly not the most conservative, but not the most extreme.
So what might the preponderance of the current evidence suggest would be the shift?
Well, well, you know what? I'm not going to answer that fully right now because they're actually running new models as we speak for this next AR5 IPCC report. The 07 was the fourth report. This next one will be out in a couple years. They're just getting together groups and chapter authors, and they're instilling new regulations for the IPCC for checks and balances. But getting back to the science, literally down the road at Princeton at NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab, they're doing model runs for the AR5. So I don't want to say for sure what the new model runs are going to say. I've heard bits and pieces, but it's premature to jump on that yet. So it's okay once in a while to say, I don't know. We're going to have to wait and see. In the next couple of years, though, we're going to have better model projections than we had just 5 years ago.
My question was about the picture you showed at the beginning showed New Brunswick being sort of flooded. Excuse me. And you said the intensity and the sort of peaks and valleys of storms would increase. Just for Essex and Union County with the development, could you sort of speculate on what, like, the drainage and the impermeability would suggest for some of these places that have high development and sort of poor drainage, if you will?
Flash floods. That's the difference. The Raritan didn't flood in 99, 07, and 10. The Delaware in 04, 05, 06 because of impervious surfaces. They flooded because there was a heck of a lot of rain over a large part of the basin in a relatively short amount of time. However, if you're talking about Union, Elizabeth, Newark, and you put down a couple of inches of rain in a short period of time, you're going to get flooding that is absolutely influenced by the human component. So you have to segregate your flooding. The longer-term basin-wide flooding, you know, people say to me, yeah, but the Delaware Basin has a lot more development in it than in the past. Do you realize the Delaware Basin has a lot more forest in it than it had a century ago? Most of this area was deforested in the late 19th century. How come we didn't have floods galore then? Because not that those surfaces were impervious, but they weren't forested with the roots and such to hold that water in. So it's not all about the human component when it comes to major river basin flooding. But it is when you're talking about municipal flooding. So you guys have to factor in both. And they both may increase in magnitude with our changing climate. Challenges. That's what you want. Should have called it transportation challenges. Thank you.